Robert Anthony Siegel's memoir, Criminals, My Family's Life on Both Sides of the Law, chronicles a childhood that is, at the same time, a classic New York story and utterly unique. His father was a criminal defense attorney who represented drug dealers and Hell's Angels, while his mother was determined to turn her children into sophisticated culture mavens. Criminals is published by Counterpoint Press, and I'm happy that it brings Robert Anthony Siegel to our show. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, excellent. We're delighted to have you. In this book, your father comes across as this very unique, larger-than-life figure, both literally and figuratively. Can you just give our listeners some background about how he wound up representing and sometimes even befriending people like the Hell's Angels, characters like the Hell's Angels?
Well, it's a great question. And of course, I was a small boy. And so your parents simply, when you're a child, your parents simply are. Mm-hmm. And they seem so magnificent. My father was this enormously open, expansive, charismatic guy. And it was the late 60s, the early 70s. So I guess you would call it the counterculture was in a ferment. There was an exploding drug culture. Most of his early clients were marijuana dealers, and they were interesting people because they were world travelers. They had, you know, traveled the overland route to Afghanistan, and he just was great with people. Everybody loved him.
Did he bring those people around? Were they at the house? Were you with him when he was meeting with them in his office? I mean, how did you come into contact with them as a boy?
Yeah, well, he didn't make much distinction between work and private life, and he was the kind of guy who didn't like to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
So he always had a group of people with him. He sort of traveled with a kind of entourage or a traveling circus. And he would pick me up at school. I went to a little private school called the 15th Street School, which was, it's gone now, but it was on 15th Street and 7th Avenue. And there would be, you know, three or four clients in the back seat. And I would sort of spend time at the office before going home. And I would just sit and listen. And we were always sort of rushing out to dinner because he was a guy who really liked to eat. And so there would always be a ton of people at a big table in a restaurant. And I, as a child, I so enjoyed being part of that mix. It made me feel like I was at the center of the universe.
Yeah, sure. Was there a romantic idea in your family about his law practice, that he was representing members of the counterculture, that he wasn't just your typical, you know, white-collar lawyer, that he was doing something different?
Yeah, and it's hard to go back to those times. I think those, at the time around Watergate, the counterculture, the hippie movement, they were really transformative for America. And to some extent, we've integrated those ideas into the way we think about ourselves. But parts of that have been lost. Hmm. There was a great mistrust of the government. The Vietnam War was clearly a disaster. Ordinary people had a sense that their government was lying to them about the war. And these things mixed together with my father's law practice. And he had himself, he had a view of himself as protecting people on the margins from the man. Mm-hmm. You know, that old term, the man, with a capital M. And to some extent, I think there was a certain validity to that. And to some extent, it was self-serving. And those two things mixed to the point where nobody knew where one began and the other stopped.
What do you mean by self-serving? And that it was also his business.
It was his business. It was not only his business, it was his pleasure and his identity and the drama of opposition. And of he loved, I think, being a protector, being the first person you called when you were in trouble.
Yeah.
He loved running out in the middle of the night down to the precinct or finding a judge to sign a bail order, all that stuff. He loved it.
But then he was the one who eventually got into trouble. Can you explain the backstory there? What happened? I mean, your book is called Criminals, My Family's Life on Both Sides of the Law.
Yeah, it's as with everything about my dad, it's extremely complicated and a little bit absurd. And and you can see, you know, when I go back and replay those that chain of events, just one slight difference could have made everything come out a little better. Essentially, he had a client, very young man, teenager, sort of a out on the street, a kind of drifter who was selling small amounts of drugs. He had many clients like this. His clients sort of, he took everybody and anything. He wouldn't turn a dollar away. So he had clients who were selling joints in Washington Square Park, and he had clients who were moving large amounts of marijuana or were allegedly doing so. And so this was one of those, just sort of a street kid who came in the office and was sort of connected to others. And he represented him on a small case involving, I think, some LSD. And it looked like it wasn't going to turn out well. And the boy was out on bail, and he decided to run. He felt like he couldn't serve the jail time.
The boy did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he told my father, and my father told him, well, pay off the bail bondsman, because the police won't come looking for you, but the bail bondsman will.
Uh-huh.
That was his first mistake.
Yeah.
Right. You can't do things like that. And there are complicated rules about what you can and can't do. And I think my father's identification was very strong with his clients, his need to please and be of service. Eventually, this boy grew up and was still sort of in the drug business. He came back to my father's office with a new name, a different identity, and sort of started to hang around. And the two men were sort of lunch buddies. Mm. And without ever acknowledging that they actually knew each other from before, because this new client was a fugitive, and he was living under an alias. And I think my father justified it to himself at the time, because he wasn't doing any legal work for him. It wasn't paid. They were really just hanging out, which is odd in itself.
Sure.
But my dad was somebody who always needed people to hang out with.
Yeah.
He needed the attention. He needed people laughing at his jokes. And eventually, this client was arrested again for new crimes. My father got swept up into that investigation. And obviously, he had made some mistakes. He was vulnerable. And he ended up serving some time in at the minimum security, a federal camp, Danbury, Connecticut. But the real hard part for him and for our family was the investigation, which went on for years.
They were investigating him for being complicit in some sort of larger criminal conspiracy. Is that what they were looking at?
Because this client, in order to save himself, was trying to sell anybody he could, and had exaggerated all sorts of allegations involving my father.
So he tried to implicate your father. Okay.
Yeah. And eventually, all that stuff was taken off the table. It wasn't true. But it took years, and it destroyed his practice. And he had always been... If you knew him, he's passed away. He died in 2002. But if you knew him, he had a real fragility to him. Mm. Though he was extremely forceful and charismatic, you could see that there was something brittle. He really had a complete breakdown. Mm. By the time he went away to prison, he was just...
He was only there for a short period of
time.
But it really changed him.
It was so humiliating to, I guess, end up on the other side. And I think in many ways, the thing he most feared and had worked his life to protect people against. It was just terrible. He came out and he was really a shard of himself.
The other aspect that you delve into about your father is his love of food and the role that food played in your childhood and these enormous meals you would have in Chinatown and late night jaunts around the city looking for a good place to eat. Do you think your father used food as a sort of crutch in a way? Was it a means of socializing, or was it something deeper?
Yeah, I think it was all those things. I think we were all connected to food in this complicated way. It was a pacifier. It was a tranquilizer. It was soothing. But it was also social and loving and something you could enjoy with somebody. And it was something to do. He was a terrible insomniac. Mm. So it was something to do at 3 a.m, a place to go. He eventually joined Overeaters Anonymous. And I don't think it helped much, but he said he got great restaurant tips there.
I bet.
So he would come back always with a new place to go.
You later discover Japanese language and culture, and you enter this whole different world. Was that a way of distancing yourself from the craziness that was some of your home life, or was it just happenstance?
No, I think it was. But of course, I can only say that with the benefit of hindsight now. I think at the time I was just searching for what a friend of mine recently called a hard reboot, mm-hmm. you know, just to sort of reformat the computer in my head and fill it with a different operating system. And of course, when you study a language, if you've ever had that experience, the world itself runs through language. So different language, different world.
Huh. And different way of thinking.
Exactly. And different way of feeling.
You also you took up judo and uh-huh. you became a vegetarian. Were these also counters to what you had experienced as a kid in a way, in terms of the health consciousness of both of those things?
I think they did relate. The vegetarianism came much later in my life after my father died. I wanted to give something up as a way of remembering him, and of a way of acknowledging my sadness that he was gone. And I just felt like I wanted to step off the karmic chain, if you know what I mean, for mm-hmm. a moment. And just, you know, I felt, I write in the book, I felt like, obviously, he died of natural causes. But when somebody dies and you love them, you feel like they've been murdered. Hmm. You know, it's just not right. It doesn't yeah. feel right. And I was like, why am I eating this hamburger?
Wow.
I mean, why am I... Somebody else has been murdered for this hamburger. Obviously, it's a cow, but
sure.
but still. And so, and I've never regretted that decision.
Interesting. You wrote this memoir as a collection of essays. Wondering why you decided to do that as opposed to going in a straight chronological way. Why did you decide to tell the story in pieces like that?
Well, in part because it was a long time till I could even imagine telling the entire story through. And I think I had to back into it. Mm-hmm. And so I started with little pieces and then started to understand the relationship between the pieces and fill in the gaps. And I think ultimately, and then I was sort of wedded to the idea. I like the fragmentary approach because when I look back at my own life with any honesty, memory is fragmentary.
Absolutely.
And it's a little bit like a stained glass window. You see pieces fitting together, and yet they're clearly gaps.
Yeah.
And so it feels truer to the experience of remembering, for me.
You are, in this book, remembering the New York City of the 70s and 80s, but I understand you now live in North Carolina. Is it odd to come back here? What's different about New York? You're here today. Is it just dramatically different from...
Well, I come back every summer. My family is still here. We stay with my mother, who's in Midtown, and recharge for a couple of months. And obviously, New York has changed enormously. I look for some of the architecture, the buildings that were important to me way back then, and they're gone.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there's a remarkable amount that's really the same. And there's something about the spirit of the place that I find so revitalizing and so powerful. And I just feel myself expanding as I get here.
Well, I'm glad this book brought you back to New York for the summer. Thank you for joining me today,
Thank
Robert.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. I appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Robert Anthony Siegel about his new book, Criminals, My Family's Life on Both Sides of the Law. It's published by Counterpoints.